Hey there, it's Antrice, and welcome to another episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast.
The Savvy Painter Podcast is published every other Thursday on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher Radio, Amazon Music, Pandora, and just about every podcast app out there. If you are a painter or an artist who is looking for down-to-earth, real-life conversations about art, how to create it, and how to sell it, you are in the right place. And guess what, you guys? The Savvy Painter Podcast has been downloaded over 3 million times. I'm not really sure when we hit that milestone. It must have been a couple months ago, but I can say it now. The Savvy Painter Podcast has been downloaded over 3 million times by artists in more than 150 countries. This is the place where you will find your community, you'll be inspired to create, and you'll hear real stories from artists who are thriving with their art. So if you are new to this podcast, welcome. You know, a lot of artists have told me that this podcast helps them feel more secure in their painting practice. And they say that it's not so lonely knowing that there are other artists out there who are working hard at building their foundations and obsessing over their painting practice. If that's you and you'd like to take what you're learning here on the podcast, apply it, and go even deeper, I'm inviting you to join the Savvy Painter community. Last week, I opened it up to the public, and it's so much fun to see you guys in there. So it's a community of like-minded artists who know that we're in this for the long haul. They're continually working to master their craft in a private community of hardworking artists. So if that sounds like something fun for you, head on over to savvypainter.com and join us. We are waiting for you. My guest this week on the podcast is Gerard Gutierrez. Gerard is a landscape painter out of the East Bay in California. And when Gerard was a kid, he rode his bike over to the Richmond Art Center to show them his portfolio of Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle drawings. And what I love about this is that the artists at the Richmond Art Center didn't even bat an eye. They just took him under their wing. In this episode, we talk about the lasting impact of that encounter. It's a beautiful example of how powerful local art centers can be in the communities that they serve. And Gerard continues to repay the kindness today by mentoring the kids at Reach Ashland Youth Center in San Leandro, California. We also talk about what it really means to be a working artist. Gerard worked as an assistant to muralist John Worley, who taught him a lot about this career. But one of Gerard's biggest takeaway was the importance of having a diversified income stream. Before we jump into this interview, though, I want to give a shout out and say thank you to Jojo Wolf Cosmic in Great Britain for leaving a review on Apple Podcast. Jojo left a 5-star review and said, "Listening while I paint. Thank you, Antrice, for this wonderful podcast and for being a lot of fun to listen to whilst I paint. I finished a painting today listening to a couple of your casts, and it inspired me to keep going, allowed me to stop criticizing myself and just allow my process to flow. I don't have that all elusive community of artists around me, so it's great to feel connected." Jojo, I am so glad that you're still painting away and staying connected to your own process and flow. So thank you so much for taking the time to leave that review. Now, some of you guys know, and you've been asking about it, we have a goal to hit 1,000 reviews on Apple Podcasts by the end of the year. As of the recording of this podcast episode, we are at 835 5-star reviews worldwide. So big thank you to Jojo and everyone else who's helping out with that goal. I think we're going to do it. I'm excited. I also think that you are going to have a lot of takeaways from this conversation with Gerard Gutierrez. For my part, I'm just happy that he's out there painting these gorgeous landscapes and making the world a better place with his work with the kids at Reach Ashland Youth Center. Okay, without further ado, here is Gerard Gutierrez. Gerard, thank you so much for being on the Savvy Painter Podcast.
Thank you. I'm excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. Tell us about how you started out as an artist. What made you decide to pursue this vocation?
I actually decided to become an artist at a really young age, and I'm blessed to actually have a lot of support, or had a lot of support at a really young age, and still have that support. And I think that's really a crucial sort of key to my development as a young person, as a young artist. And there was also other couple key things as well that really pushed me at a young age to decide this was going to be the direction I go. I think the first one, really just being in a creative household. I owe a lot to my mother as far as my sort of artistic prowess and sort of even my just desire to be an artist. My mom is an extremely sort of creative and crafty person. I don't know if she would necessarily label herself an artist,
mm-hmm.
but to me, she is an artist. And at a very young age, my mom was always into sort of crafting and sewing, felting. She's an amazing seamstress. She would dabble in painting and all sorts of things. And so when I was young, she would constantly put those things in my hand and allow me to explore art and was constantly encouraging me to do that. So from that early age and from that standpoint, it really pushed me to know that this was a dream that I can pursue. And so from there, another really big step that happened at a young age was that I got involved with the Richmond Arts Center in Richmond, California. The Richmond Arts Center, I believe, is actually the longest continuously running public arts center in the West Coast.
Oh, really? I didn't know that.
Yeah, there's a lot of claim to fame at the Richmond Arts Center, despite the fact that it's not necessarily a well-known organization. And it's also in a city that is known for other things besides their art community, mm-hmm. although the art community there is amazing. So, I mean, a quick note would be that I think the second place to show Jasper John's work in the West Coast, I think Jasper John had a show in LA and then had a show in Richmond before wow. Oakland or San Francisco or anywhere else. Of course, he'd shown in New York by then. But
so was this a center that, like, as a kid growing up, you always kind of knew about it, or did you discover it one day?
I discovered it one day. And so the Richmond Arts Center is a community arts center that has a community gallery as well as a traditional gallery. I say community gallery because they show emerging and community artists as well as established artists. And they have three large galleries. And then there's also classes there as well as other sort of art advocacy and community relations things that they do there. And so I got involved with them at a young age, just riding my bike and just going there. And they had art classes there. And then at the time, I couldn't necessarily afford the classes there.
Mm-hmm.
So what was interesting is that my mom helped write a letter and give me some support with trying to ask for a scholarship. And at the time, they didn't necessarily have scholarships. So I rode my bike there. I had this letter in my hand. I had this portfolio in my hand as well. And I went there and I asked to speak to somebody. And at the time, Rachel Osojima, who is currently the arts commissioner for the Alameda County. And at the time, she was the exhibition director there. And she came out and said, you know, sure, I'll look at your portfolio. And it was really bad, like Ninja Turtle drawings and comic books and things like that. And then she sort of flipped through it. And I think she looked at my mom's letter. And then a few days later, they gave me a call and said that I could take some classes there.
Oh, my God. Wait, so how old were you when you did this?
Oh, maybe 11
years
old. Oh, my
God, that's so cute.
11.
If I were her, my heart would have just melted at that. If an 11-year-old kid rode his bike and showed up and said, like, hey, can I come study art here? Here's a letter of recommendation from my mom.
Don't forget my portfolio. Was it like an actual, like, one of those Ayatollahs? I don't know if it was that brand at the time, but it was maybe just like a three-wing binder with, like, those slip sheets. I think I still have it somewhere. Now I want to go look for it. But it was like, I'm sure it was just like ninja drawings and Ninja Turtles, things like that. So that sparked a relationship that lasted an extremely long time that had many different forms. But one of the things that happened when I was there at the Richmond Arts Center and a relationship that I built there was that I became sort of this annoying sort of mosquito that was constantly coming in there and just bugging teachers, bugging the administration, volunteering for everything that I could. And that sparked a lot of relationships with a lot of the folks there, including somebody who I hold really dear, a mentor of mine, John Worley. John Worley's a well-known West Coast muralist. I mean, he's actually internationally known, but he has a lot of murals throughout the West Coast from LA through all the way up to Seattle area. And so John Worley was working on a extremely large mural in the city of Richmond. And anyone listening who's from Richmond knows the mural that's called Revisionist History. It's on an underpass, below an underpass over off of Barrett Avenue for those that are local.
Mm-hmm.
The significance of this story is that at the time, the city was doing a job placement program
mm-hmm.
for young people, summer job program for young people. And I went there to go get a summer job and they ask you a bunch of questions. What are you into? What do you like? What are your skills? And as I was discussing, I can listen well and I can stock shelves. I don't remember the name of the person who was interviewing me and was asking, what do you really like to do? And I started talking about my passion for art and that I volunteer at the Richmond Arts Center. And then they said, well, actually, we have a man who's looking to have some assistants help him on a mural project. So
no.
I got in contact with John Worley. And this was a little bit later. So at this point, I worked with the Richmond Arts Center, taking classes.
Do you remember how old you were?
I believe I was 15 years old, 14 or 15 years old. And at this point, I had a longstanding relationship with the Richmond Arts Center. I could talk about the Richmond Arts Center forever. I mean, one of the other things I did there, going back to your original question, was that I did a nude figure drawing. I think I was maybe 13. Between the age of 13 and 16, I did nude figure drawing at the Richmond Arts Center. There at the time, don't necessarily remember what the rules were. I do know my parents signed a waiver or, you know, let them know that I could do that because of the sensitive nature of doing that. And so
right.
That was really great. I mean, having, again, going back to my mom, I mean, just having somebody who was extremely encouraging around practicing art and like being an artist and really having that sort of that mindset as an artist. So for her, it wasn't any weirdness around like drawing nude figures. It was like, well, that's what professional artists do, so you're going to do that.
It's so funny because like the contrast is like when I first, and I was in San Francisco, first figure drawing class I took, I think I was like 19 or 20 and I didn't think about it. It was just like, oh, figure drawing. And I'm like, oh, great. And I walk in and I'm sitting there and we're all like looking at this stage part, but there was no model yet. And then this like older Asian man walks in a robe and just dropped his robe and I froze. Like, I don't know what I was thinking, but I was just like, well, duh. But it was so funny.
When I first did it as well, it's kind of the same experience. Like in my head, I'm like, okay, I'm going to, because at that point I've seen nude figure drawings. Like I had books and things like that.
But they're drawings, so right?
Yeah, exactly. So then to have the person in front of you, and there's also, I mean, now as a professional artist, I kind of know that's a whole world. There's a love and respect for the artist model.
Completely.
The artist and the model that goes back hundreds of years.
Yeah.
But as a 13-year-old boy, it's shocking. You're like, oh, I really am drawing a naked person. You don't even use the word, like the idea of nude figure drawing is gone. You're just like, that's a naked person.
Yeah, it was the exact same thing. It was so, every time I think about that, I just laugh. And you think like you're sophisticated or whatever. And I think that's a US-based thing that like you see somebody nude and you're like, oh.
Yeah, exactly. Because even just the semantics of it, I mean, the idea around just the word nude and drawing. And then for me as a young person seeing that, it was like, you're not supposed to be naked in public and there's a naked person in front of me. Mm-hmm. And I know I signed up for this, but there's this sort of disconnect between like what's a societal norm and then what's actually in front of you. So you have to kind of.
Yeah, and you're not supposed to stare either, but you have to.
Yeah, you're not supposed to stare. And then the instructor is like, you should be looking at the model more than your paper.
Yeah.
Like, I don't know, but are they like that?
I was just going to say that when you first started talking about your relationship with the Richmond Art Center, you described yourself as an annoying mosquito who was always around. And I just think like everything that you've told me sort of contradicts that. Are you sure about that?
I'll double down and say yes, but it was through the love and the patience of the people there. And the reason I say that is that now that I'm adult and I work with young people, you can get sort of mentorship fatigue. And then especially when it's not even fatigue for having empathy. That never goes away. But it's the idea around like the ability to have an impact and do my work is on the foundation of the work that I do behind the scenes. So in order for me to give the young people that I work with the best, the work that I do behind the scenes needs to happen. Mm-hmm. So thinking back to your question, the folks that would open their door when it was appropriate would give me 110% of their attention and time and effort. And then when the door was closed and they should have been working on their grant writing, and I'm like, what's a grant? How do you write it? Can I see? I understand now that that was probably annoying. They were probably like, well, you're not going to get any classes because you're going to mess up this grant. Obviously, I'm being a bit facetious and I'm saying it, you know, affectionately, but mm-hmm. I definitely owe a lot to the folks that allowed me to be a mosquito.
It sounds like they adore you for it because you still have those strong relationships.
Yes, I'm still very well connected with all of them. And one of the things I wanted to point out or bring up with John Worley and the mural that I worked on mm-hmm. that's really significant for me and made becoming an artist a reality for me was this idea around a working artist and what does it mean to be a working artist? Mm-hmm. And being around the Richmond Art Center and people like John Worley really showed me what that actually looks like in practice.
Was there anything about that that kind of surprised you? I mean, because you came from a background where your mom was super creative. So on the creative side, everything seems like it would be, I don't want to say expected, but at least you're familiar with it. But the way that you described your mom, it was more super creative for herself.
Short answer is yes to everything you just said. I think the longer answer is that my mom's creativity and her sort of desire to push me in the direction of the artist probably has a little bit to do with, I think my mom had ideas growing up around maybe even taking classes. She had thoughts around going to CCA, the California College of Arts. Mm-hmm. At the time, it was the California College of Arts and Crafts, I believe, and they changed their name a few years ago. Mm-hmm. And then life got in the way, and then she wasn't able to pursue that. And so for my mom, I mean, a lot of it really was around the idea of just being creative and exploring your creative side, regardless of whatever your career path is.
Right.
And I think despite the fact that she was pushing me towards embracing creativity, having a reference point for art as a career path is really important for the young person's development and seeing that you can make that happen. Mm-hmm. And so it seems so abstract and sort of foreign and or even just unattainable to be a professional artist and what that looks like. And I think part of that as well is, one, if you don't know any professional artists, and two, the media doesn't necessarily show what a working artist is. The media, I find, this is gross simplification and sort of generalization, so I know that, but I would argue that media, and that's all media, shows artists as either these eccentric millionaire avant-garde artists, or they're this bohemian starving artist.
Right. And not very intelligent.
Yes. And just a burden to all other families. So those are the two extremes that you see even as an early age of what it means to be an artist.
I mean, all you have to do is just go to any stock photography website and search for artist studio. And inevitably, what you're going to find is somebody in a striped shirt and a beret with paint all over themselves, because apparently we can't paint without getting it all over ourselves. You know, that whole starving artist thing, or when you see artists portrayed in movies, it's either this desperately poor and obsessive compulsive behavior and an alcohol and or drug problem.
Yes, all those things is what you associate with being an artist. And so the idea for me around being what I call a working artist, I've heard that term used with other people as well. And so this idea between that it's a vocation and that it is a job. But then also for me, a working artist also has a diversified income stream. Mm-hmm. And I think that was also one of the other really big things that I learned was there's this idea as well, is that your only avenue is either just illustration. When I say illustration, I'm also referring to the industries like Pixar and game industry and things like that. Commercial arts, I'll say. And then fine art and selling paintings. That's the only way to do it. And so what I discovered with folks like John Worley and other people as well is that there's multiple ways to earn an income being creative.
Yeah. And that's kind of where I was going with that question for you about, was there a surprise when you met John Worley about what it meant to be an artist as a career who's making their living off of their art or making their living as an artist?
Not necessarily. I think for me, the surprise was that it was a job, meaning at that point for me, art was a creative outlet. And so you draw and paint because it's fun, because you want to. If you're not in the mood, you don't paint and you don't draw. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of this entertaining lifestyle around drawing. Mm-hmm. When I started working on the mural with John, it was a job. It was, you get up and you show up at the job site at 7 a.m. to work on a mural. And if you're not feeling creative, you still paint the mural. Mm-hmm. And then there's taxes and then there's expenses and you have to treat it as a job.
What effect did that have on you? Like, how did you internalize that?
That it was something that I can do because it no longer seemed, I don't even know what the word would be. Like, being an artist seemed so dreamlike. It was like, you can be an actor.
Right.
I'm thinking of all the jobs that have such small percentages, whether it's becoming a professional athlete, becoming an actor and things like that. You know, what's interesting that I'm saying that now is that there's parallels to both of those things. I think there's this idea that if you're a great athlete in high school and college, your path is a professional NFL player. Mm-hmm. But then look at all the amazing people that end up being physical therapists and coaches for little leagues and high school PE teachers and things like that, that still maintain that creative spirit and are still doing that sort of work. Same thing with acting. You know, not everyone's going to be Brad Pitt, but there are plenty of people who make a living doing voiceover for commercials and small bit roles in plays and make a living. And that's really what I learned with the Richmond Arts Center and meeting a lot of working artists, was this idea that it is attainable and it's practical and it's not what you envision. It isn't me in the studio splashing paint around and wealthy collectors come in and give you money. It's a job. You teach on Mondays and Wednesdays, and then you work on your paintings Tuesdays and Thursdays, and then those will go into a gallery 6 months from now. But then you're also taking a mural job, and you're also doing, you know, at the time it was even, you know, websites were starting to come up, and a lot of my friends were doing that sort of work. So it was around being creative and diversifying your creativity to produce income. Mm-hmm. And I think that's what really affected me at that age, was seeing it in a practical terms and not these sort of lofty dream, like, I want to be an artist, and then not knowing what that looks like. If you don't know any artist, if you don't know any gallery owners, if you're not in that world, it seems so foreign and it seems so distant, and it doesn't seem like you can attain that. And then to meet somebody who says, this is my job. And again, I keep emphasizing that word because the idea is that this isn't my...
It's not a hobby.
Exactly. It's not a hobby. And it's also not this sort of creativity on a whim and the idea that it's work.
Yeah. And you have to take it seriously. I think one of the best analogies that I've heard in terms of like, no, you show up whether you want to or not. And the myth of the sort of the muse and the like, I only work when I feel like it. I guess that's fine, but you're not going to have a whole lot of opportunities that way if you only work when you feel like it. And the analogy that I was going to mention was a surgeon doesn't just go in to the operating room when she feels like it, you know, and you want a surgeon who's going to show up and know that this isn't just like when she feels like it, that she's walking in and she has a job to do and it has nothing to do with her feelings.
Yeah. We have to reschedule your appointment. The doctor was not in the mood today.
Yeah. Just, I thought I was, and I came in and I looked around. I'm like, no, I'm just not feeling it.
The doctor read their horoscope. It's a no-go for today.
That's right. I think it was Harry Stushinoff who said that, you know, he thinks of art as a very blue collar activity, meaning exactly what you said. You roll up your sleeves and you get to work. You go into your studio. You have a job to do and you go in and you do your job. It just happens to be a lot of fun.
Exactly. Yes. And even I mentioned this a few times, but even the idea around the diversified income streams was also really eye opening for me as well.
And yeah.
I can think of a few friends that are successful painters.
Mm-hmm.
That through social media look like all they do is get commissions and sell paintings in galleries, and that's how they make their living. Where in reality, behind closed doors, or not necessarily behind closed doors, but in their other life, they are teachers or they're graphic designers or they do other works around the creative field. Like they're still maintaining that creativity and they're still using that muscle in order to have employment and income streams coming in. And I think that was a really important lesson to see that early on, as well as this idea that it isn't just about doing one thing.
Yeah.
And then giving up. Because I think there's this idea that, well, if I don't sell enough paintings, then I just can't be an artist. So then I'll be an accountant then.
Yeah. Or that if they can't live off of the sales of their art, that they're a failure. I think that is a huge issue.
Yes, definitely.
So you were so lucky that person who was interviewing you asked you, what else do you like to do besides stocking shelves, which introduced you to John Worley. You know, as we're talking, I'm thinking, how lucky are the kids that you mentor? And I'm wondering if you can talk about that a little bit.
Yes. So I work for the Alameda County Office of Education, the ACOE. And despite that it says Alameda County in the name, it is a state organization, a state government agency. And I'm in the SEL department, which is the Social Emotional Learning Department. But I'm stationed at the Reach Ashland Youth Center in San Leandro, California. It's a large, amazing $24 million facility in the heart of San Leandro. It's on East 14th and 164th. And that's where I run an arts program with another gentleman, Joaquin Newman. Joaquin Newman's a local Bay Area artist and muralist, as well as a business partner of mine. So we have an arts program at the Reach Ashland Youth Center. And Reach actually is an acronym. It stands for Recreation, Education, Arts, Career, and Health. And we are the A in Reach. And now I'm getting stuck. My own program.
What do you see your role as an artist in influencing the youth in your community?
That's a good question. The work that I do around the arts in the community is really about building the creative muscle and sort of building agency and establishing sort of a growth mindset with the young people.
Mm-hmm.
It isn't necessarily about the arts for art's sake.
Mm-hmm.
Now, within our program, we do have a lot of young people that, you know, identify as artists or want to improve their artistic skills. And so we're there for them and we support them. The name of the program is the Arts and Creativity Program. The Arts and Creativity Program, it really is about art in practice through all aspects of life and sort of integration into your life in general. So the idea isn't that we're not just targeting the art kids and the art students. The idea is that how can art support your life in all aspects?
Yeah, that's exactly what I would love for you to talk about is for non-artists in a way, because since so much art education has been cut from the schools, I think as a society, as a community, even if your profession or you don't identify as an artist, learning about the arts teaches you so many skills that are, I think, critical for all aspects of your life. And so it sounds like you guys focus a lot on that. Is that right?
Yes. So with the program, there's a lot of mentorship that's happening there with the young people. And then what's interesting about the youth center that we work with, the age is 11 to 24.
Wow. That's a huge range.
It's pretty remarkable. And we're not servicing 11 to 20-year-olds in the same space. Mm-hmm. Well, not necessarily, but for multiple reasons, they're not always in the same space. But there is a wide range that we're working with. But what's really special about that is this idea around cascading mentorship, and that the young people that we're working with, that as they get older, they are then supporting the generation that is then moving in to fill in the spot that they once were. Mm-hmm. When you ask if art education in schools is necessary, most adults will unequivocally say yes. However, when pressed on the actual merits of art education, many people do not elaborate past like standard answers of self-expression and self-esteem. But you don't really have to look too far to see some studies with quantifiable data. Mm-hmm. I wish there was more, and that's a whole other conversation around quantitative and qualitative data around art education. But for me, art education in our schools, it plays a vital role. And I think people kind of miss the boat on what that role is. I think they see it as an elective. Mm-hmm. As opposed to supporting social emotional health, mm-hmm. as well as promoting academic and personal growth. The explorative process of art allows youth a space to make sense of their world through nonverbal communication. And the infinite ways in which art allows you to share an idea gives you unique perspective on how they can communicate with the world around them, especially at such a vulnerable time in their life with so much growth and uncertainty. They need ways to sort of make sense of the world. Mm-hmm. And so art allows that space for them to try to figure things out in a nonverbal way, which really supports their emotional growth and their social emotional intelligence. And I haven't even started talking about like creative problem solving that is inherent in the arts.
Exactly. That's what I was thinking about. It's like abstract thinking.
Yes. I mean, the problem solving involved in there and that sort of growth mindset around the persistence in a project or a creative outlet. There's a through line there. There's a link that threads all scholastic subjects together in a way that sort of promotes their growth.
Yeah, I think to me, when we talk about the impact of removing art education from schools, drawing, painting, acting, singing, the skill set, I think is important. But I think what everybody misses when they talk about that is exactly that, the abstract thinking, being able to associate two ideas that are completely non-related and finding a common thread through them. I think that is where people who are not artists really need to study the arts, whether it is visual arts or performance arts or writing or poetry. It's that I think of it sort of like as like a pinball machine, I guess. And sometimes it's not verbal, it's visual. And so we have a hard time articulating it like I am right now. But like all these different dots that feel unrelated and being able to connect them in new and exciting ways is how we innovate. And innovation is essential in every single field that I can think of, like product design and social issues and everything. And that's the thing that I think we're watching just kind of die on the vine because we've taken arts out of the schools mostly.
Yes. And I think there's obviously multiple reasons for that. Mm-hmm. I think a part of that as well is just the advocacy or the lack of advocacy around it. And mm-hmm. seeing, again, it's the narrative around like, what is art good for? Mm-hmm. And if the idea is that we're trying to build a society or a cohort of young people that are intelligent, it seems like, well, an elective or something that just expresses yourself is something we can easily cut. Mm-hmm. Well, and what's interesting, though, is that that's not necessarily true. What I'm referring to is that seeing that as not important, and, you know, I don't want to necessarily be controversial, but that's not what's happening in a lot of the private schools and or schools in more affluent areas. Even if it's indirect, where the students are maybe not getting that attention in class, those students are still getting that work outside of school because they have the parents with the means to do that. And I think that's a really important part of the narrative, because it's very easy to say arts doesn't necessarily support academic growth and we need budgets for more math teachers, which we do. We just need a larger budget in general. So let's remove it from schools because it's not as important. Meanwhile, schools in the sort of private sector in more affluent areas are like, that's great. You guys do that. I'm still putting my child into an after-school program that costs $700 a week.
Right.
And then the Reach Ashton Youth Center is actually free for all residents of Alameda County.
Wow.
And so one of the things that your listeners might be interested in is one of our frameworks that we work with is the Studio Habits of Mind. Mm-hmm. I don't know if you're familiar with that. The Studio Habits of Mind are the 8 habits that were identified by Project Zero, Harvard's Project Zero. I would recommend anyone just Googling Harvard and Project Zero and looking at the studies and findings around art education. And what the Studio Habits of Mind are, and the reason we utilize those in our classroom is that it's less about a practical skill necessarily, and it is around, they identified what are 8 sort of practices / mindsets that artists utilize to support their artistic careers that lend themselves to all careers in all aspects of life. And so the idea, the 8 of them, I can quickly say them are stretch and explore, express, develop craft, envision, understand the arts community, observe, engage and persist, and reflect. And so they identified these as practices that artists would do. So I could take a couple of them. The idea around reflection, the idea of reflecting on a low-hanging fruit would be just reflecting on a piece of art. Like, let me look at this piece of art and see what's wrong with it. I mean, one of the things I tell my students, especially my older students, is if they don't like something, I tell them, why don't you like it? And let's fix that. Mm-hmm. And for those who have never taught an art class before, what's significant about that is that, especially when you work with younger students, it is different. That's not necessarily how I would approach it. But there's this idea as you get older that you're getting support from everyone around you, but that doesn't necessarily give you any growth. And so the idea is that if a student doesn't like their piece of art, I'm not there to give them a sort of superficial pep talk because I feel that that's what they need. I'm there to acknowledge that they don't like it, but what I want is for them to figure out why they don't like it, as opposed to, I sometimes see very misguided attempts of, like, the student says they don't like it, to quickly try to redirect them as far as building self-esteem. And I see the point in that and say, well, that's not that bad. You tried really hard. Instead, I'm like, that's great. You don't like it. Tell me why you don't like it so we can do another one that's even better. And so this idea around reflection is that, how do you look at something and then reflect? And that's just looking at a piece of art.
Right.
Reflect can also just be on your life, on your ideology, the way you see the world. Another really great one is the idea around engage and persist. Anyone who paints, all your listeners who paint, everyone knows that paintings have an ugly middle stage. How do you work with a 13-year-old trying to convince them that another hour on a painting they just spent 3 hours is really going to make it pop?
Not just 13-year-olds, I'll tell you that. It goes beyond that.
Exactly. What's another really good one? I mean, the idea around understanding your arts community is really around networking and the ability to network, and how do you do that? And that's a really easy one that parallels with almost all industries.
Mm-hmm. I really like what you said about engaging and reflecting. And the thing that I like about what you said, it's, I don't know if it's a technique, but in hindsight, I think I first really felt that approach through one of my mentors, who is Tom Whittle. But what's so important about it is the mentor, that you're asking the students what they didn't like about it, or what they would want to change, or where they feel, you know, like you're asking them questions which reveal to you what their intention was, so that you know how to help them, versus let me tell you everything I think about painting and how I paint, and I'm going to kind of push my own sense of aesthetics and sense of what makes a painting complete on you. And sometimes that is appropriate, but I think more often than not, especially at the ages that you're talking to, is taking the time to learn from them what they even wanted out of the painting. Because you could go in and start telling them how to correct a drawing when that wasn't even something they're interested in.
Yes. And one of the things I like to talk a lot about with my students is the idea around arbitrary decisions. And so, especially as a realist painter and somebody who, although my paintings are relatively loose, as somebody who spends a lot of time on paintings, if there's a student who sort of takes some shortcuts, I'm fine with them taking shortcuts as long as that was an intentional decision.
Exactly.
And that sometimes throws them off a little bit. Or even just like, why did you paint that blue? And if your answer is because that was the closest color you could grab, then that's unacceptable. And we
right.
didn't paint that with, what color do you actually want? Because you didn't want to get up and go across the room. I mean, students are always asking for validation. Like, what do you think of this?
Mm-hmm.
And I also don't want to be so coy where I'm always just saying, well, what do you think of it?
No, that's not helpful either.
Yeah. So I want to be there as an instructor to support them with the skills that I've developed over the years. But at the same time, it really is about, what do you think? I could tell you why I think there's not enough contrast between those two colors. But if you tell me that's giving the mood that you want, that is an intentional decision and not arbitrary. And it doesn't matter what I think.
Yeah.
And that's one of the reasons why I love those studio habits of mind so much. It's less around skill building and really around the sort of practice and the mindset. And so that sort of growth mindset around being an artist. Anyone who is hiring for a job of any kind of job, I think that should be on all applications. Have you ever painted before? Because if you painted before and you enjoy it, then this person has problem-solving skills. They can engage and persist past the ugly stage. I think the question should be, have you ever finished a painting? You're hired.
There you go. This episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast is sponsored by Dr. P.H. Martins.
Dr. P.H. Martins was founded in 1934 in New York City. We're a third generation family business.
That's Aaron Salas.
My name is Aaron Salas, and I run Dr. P.H. Martins. We make handmade liquid color products here in California, 6 gallons at a time.
His great-grandfather worked at P.H. Martins in the early 1930s.
My great-grandfather, Benjamin Salas, worked there. At the time, it was owned by the B. Arenstein family and kind of a different generation of companies in downtown New York. He eventually came to own the company and developed several product lines and ran and managed what was a very, very small company from the late 30s all the way up until 1970 when my father, Larry, took over the business. I think I'd been involved in the business ever since I was probably about 8 years old. Me and have a younger brother. We would go in with my father and fight over who was going to get to play with the labeling machine. So when I say it's a family business, it really is just that. But when my father took over the business in the 1970s, he really expanded the product range into a lot of different kinds of products, pigment-based color, light body, soft body acrylics, different kinds of inks. We just focus on non-toxic, water-based liquid color products.
Aaron has put together a special offer just for Savvy Painter listeners. From now until October 31st, 2020, you can get all 4 sets of Radiant Concentrated for just $100. That is 56 colors in all for just $100. All you have to do is go to docmartins.com. and use the promo code SAVVY100, SAVVY, the numbers 100. You have until October 31st, 2020 to get all 4 sets of Radiant Concentrated for just $100. And of course, I will post links to this in the show notes for this episode. Oh, wait, and one more thing. I got to mention this because I'm in Argentina, so shipping, guys, especially if you're international, it matters. So in the United States, Aaron is giving free shipping if it's in the United States, and then he has set up special rates for different regions in the rest of the world. So he has got us taken care of, and I love that. I super appreciate when companies like Doc Martens take that extra step to take care of us. It also sounds like from what you've said, you've sort of hinted at the idea of deliberate practice, of like practicing with the intention of improving. Is that part of the ideas behind these 8 rules?
Yes, it is. Well, those are sort of frameworks.
Thank you. That's a much better word.
They're pedagogies, but I like to sort of categorize them as a framework that we utilize because we're using multiple frameworks. So that's just one of the main ones that we're using. Social emotional learning and mindfulness is another one. So our curriculum and our vision and mission is based around multiple frameworks to kind of overlap. So yes, the idea around that sort of deliberate practice, Anthony Wachulis, the artist, talks about that, you know, in his various social media and different posts. He has a couple really long-winded blog posts around that that I've read in the past. That was really inspiring. But yes, the idea around deliberate practice as opposed to just sort of going through the motions is a really, I think, crucial part of development and growth.
Yeah. And just to be clear here, because I did sort of throw that out there, which is a specific idea, would you mind explaining to the listeners who don't know what is meant by deliberate practice?
Yes. So I think it's sometimes easier, at least for me, in articulating deliberate practice, is to explain what non-deliberate practice would be. Mm-hmm. I think there's this idea of the 10,000 hours. For the listeners, that 10,000 hours of practice is how you become an expert at something. And so people have taken that to mean, if I just do a thing for 10,000 hours, I will get better at it. Where deliberate practice says it may take more, it may take less. However, are you going with the intention of getting better and identifying goals within that particular practice session, mm-hmm. whether it's that particular day, whether that's particular week or year of a goal towards developing and learning something? I don't know if I articulated that as well as I wanted, but I hope that's helpful.
Yeah, I think it is. I mean, this idea that it kind of goes back to what we talked about earlier with just kind of going into the studio when you feel like it. You know, sometimes people will say like, oh, well, I've been painting for, you know, 10 years or 20 years or 30 years or 50 years. And we've all had these days where you just kind of go into the studio and you paint. But when there's something that you don't know how do you go about learning it? Because just going in and saying like, oh, I don't, you know, like the mountains don't quite look right, so I'm going to just paint more mountains, right? But if you kind of go into it going like, why don't they look right? What is it that doesn't look right? What is the thing that I need to learn? Oh, I need to understand aerial perspective better and how to give the feeling that it pushes back into the environment, just as one example. Or, you know, oh, I need to actually look at how mountains are formed. Like, why do we get those like ridges in them? And what is actually happening? And learning about that so that you can paint it, and then practicing it and saying like, okay, I'm going to do this, and I'm looking to achieve this particular thing.
Yes, exactly. I think that's well said. And deliberate practice, for me, the easiest thing to say is it's not just checking off the box that you practiced that day. And I think that's what people do a lot, is just checking it off. And I think a marker for me is that although art is fun, and I believe art should always be fun, and I enjoy it, you'll know you're doing deliberate practice because you're tired afterwards.
Yes.
I think the same thing with working out, as an example. If you go through your workout routine and you don't break a sweat, yes, you worked out. You did the required number of sets and reps for your workout, but you didn't do anything. So you should be focused so hard on whatever you're painting or whatever you're doing that you're tired at the end of it, even if you were just sitting in a chair painting a landscape. And if you're not mentally exhausted afterwards, I don't know if you were practicing hard enough or deliberately enough.
Right. There's a balance, I think, between the deliberate practice and when you achieve that state of flow, but they're related. Like, another way to describe it is, God, I wish I could remember the book. I was listening to an audiobook, and the weird thing is I remember exactly where I was. I remember how cold it was that day, and I'm blanking on the author and the name of the book. But the example I thought was really fascinating. He was studying this idea of how people become great at something in deliberate practice, and he talked about going to this musician's home. It wasn't even a studio. And this kid, he was like 20 or something, and he'd been practicing this song. And the way he went about learning the song was he would just practice one small piece of it slowly over and over again until that hit muscle memory. And then, so the first stage of his deliberate practice was just, I'm going to learn these chords, these notes, how to put this section together. Then once he did that, the next step was, how fast can I play this? And so he would just, for weeks, over and over again, just going faster and faster and faster until like he knew that phrase of the music inside and out. And it is mentally exhausting, but he was doing these things so that when he got on stage, then he could riff, then he could be creative, then he could like do all the things that is, you know, kind of the fun part of his practice and get into that flow state. But the deliberate practice was just this super methodical. And I mean, it was months and months and months of him practicing just to learn this one song. And this kid, I think he's in his 20s now. I don't remember who he is, but he comes from a line of musicians, and he is one of those people that everybody thinks he's like a child prodigy and that his quote unquote talent comes from his family, but nobody sees the place that he lives is literally a bed and his guitar. And he spends months just working on that one riff.
I love that. That's such a great story.
And as artists, like, that's kind of what we do.
Exactly. Yes, that is. Yeah. I just love being hyper focused on one thing. And then seeing the results is also, you got to have some wins as well.
Yeah.
Especially working with young people, you want to give them some opportunities to have some success to keep them motivated. And adults as well. I mean, everyone needs to have some wins, some successes.
Yeah. I'd love to switch gears just a little bit and hear about your own practice, your own painting. What is it that you're currently obsessed with your own art?
I'm currently obsessed with plein air painting and landscape painting. Well, what's interesting is that I've always been obsessed with that. You know, my sort of trajectory in the art world is, although at the beginning of the discussion, I had all this support leading up to it, I found myself after graduating art school sort of overwhelmed with the idea of how to make a career out of it. Mm-hmm. And I know that I'm contradicting myself, because earlier I was saying I had all these great examples. However, this would have been in the mid 2000s when there was sort of a boom of all sorts of directions you could take, and then trying to sort of figure out what path I wanted to do. And so I started doing a lot of illustration and graphic design work to pay bills. But as a fine artist, I was doing a lot more sort of illustrative, narrative, figurative work, because I felt like that was the artist that I wanted to be. But at the time, looking back at it now, that wasn't necessarily true. That was just what I was witnessing and seeing around me. You know, there was a lot of like hot galleries in Oakland and San Francisco that were really pushing this new wave sort of fine art that was very illustrative and narrative. And I thought that's what I wanted to be. And so I was influenced heavily by that. So I had a few successes, some paintings that I sold. But then when it came down to it, doing sort of landscapes and urbanscapes is what I love doing. You know, I would ride my bike and do little gouache paintings in the Richmond Hills and the Berkeley Hills. I would take sketchbooks and lug my heavy French easel out to, you know, lakes and rivers and do paintings. Oh, yeah.
They're the best, but they are so uncomfortable.
Yes. And I would do that work because I loved it and it made me happy. But then I wouldn't share that work. I kind of thought it was pedestrian. Pedestrian in the sense of like, if everything else is sort of this avant-garde, illustrative, narrative, figurative work that seems so glamorous, a landscape, it seemed, I don't want to use the word, I had a reverence for it. I had respect for it, but it just seemed like it wasn't the direction that I could go for a career.
It's quiet.
Yes, it's quiet. But what's interesting is that like I've had the Plein Air magazine since, actually, I think I have somewhere in my garage is probably the first year of all of them that I bought at Barnes & Noble. It doesn't even exist anymore. So that's what I love doing, but I was trying to do something else. And then several years ago, listening to a podcast, maybe it was yours. I actually don't know. That would have been great if I remembered and it was yours, but it was an art podcast. And one of the things that the person was saying, because I can't remember the artist or the host, but I can remember the one thing they said. And what they said was that paint what you love, just do what you love, and then the rest will come. Now, they weren't necessarily suggesting that you don't pay attention to the marketplace and collectors and things like that, especially if you're trying to be a practicing professional artist. It isn't just, you know, do whatever you want and people will come. I think there's a sort of misconception around that as well.
Right.
I think one of your last guests, I think Max Ginberg sort of mentioned that as well, this idea around you can't just ignore what collectors want or what the public wants. Yeah. So the idea was, I was listening to this person who was saying, yes, you want to be aware of that, but just do what you love, whether that's painting pretty flowers and kittens a la, you know, Thomas Kinkade, like do what you love, no matter how mundane or pedestrian you think it is, or how wild and crazy you think it is, just paint what you love. At that point, I was like, well, what I really love is just going outdoors and painting. I mean, doing these sort of more illustrative work, that's not what I love doing. So I stopped doing that sort of work and just sort of really embraced just painting outdoors. Painting outdoors checks off all the boxes for me. Anyone who's listening who's not necessarily a landscape or specifically a plein air painter, if you enjoy nature first, you're out in nature. Check that box. It's amazing. It's beautiful. Second, hiking. If you love hiking, which kind of goes hand in hand with nature, check that box as well. Painting. I love painting. Check that box. Gadgets and gears. I know that people might be wondering, what the heck is he talking about? I have like a carbon fiber tripod. I have like two different Bouchard boxes. I have like headlamps and super light titanium spoons for my snacks. And
it's like the ultimate backpacking, you know, like where you saw the end of your toothbrush, because it's all about the weight, because cadmium is heavy. It adds up.
Yes. And I love hiking. I know a lot of plein air painters don't necessarily hike very far, but I'm laughing because not only do I hike because I love hiking, but I'm also really, really indecisive. So I'll see a spot and I'll make a mental note and then I'll just keep hiking. So usually I'll probably hike longer than I need to. Mm-hmm. I'm really envious of other plein air artists that get out their car and within minutes find an amazing composition where I could literally hike for like 2 hours and zigzag. So shedding ounces in the backpack may not seem like much for a 15-minute hike, but you start hiking an hour
with
that 40-pound backpack on, every ounce counts. So for me, it checks off all those boxes. So what am I obsessed about going out in nature and just having a dialogue with nature is that's everything. It's such a meditative experience. I think it's equal to the technical skill and the creative problem solving and the technical problem solving that happens while you're painting. Mm-hmm. It's also extremely meditative until people come and ask you questions, but that's good and bad.
Well, it sounds like where you're going, there aren't that many people who are, it's just your fellow backpackers who are going to hike that far, because most people will only go as far as they can carry their cooler.
Yeah, that's true. Well, even just the local hikes around the, because I mean, I'm really spoiled with the Bay Area. The Bay Area and just the California coast in general, there's so many amazing places to paint and hike. So I do get a lot of tourists, for better or worse. I mean, for better is their potential clients. It's also, on one hand, you could say that it's disturbing when you're trying to make a painting. On the other hand, it's nice to be validated. Everyone, you know, even as an adult, it's nice to have complete strangers tell you that your artwork is nice.
Artists sometimes talk about the need for validation, like they're being really needy or... But validation, peer validation, validation from strangers, validation in the form of collectors, it's all important. I mean, and it's all part of what makes us human. I mean, you think about like little tiny kids, little babies. Like when they do something, they turn, their instinct is to share it with somebody. Their instinct is to look at the other human in the room and say, kind of like, did you see that? How cool is that? I think that's what makes us human. And that's part of creating art, is sharing it with other people in the form of validation too, in the form of, yeah, you're doing a great job. I mean, who doesn't need that?
Yes, it's definitely needed. And it's also nice to get it. I like getting it more from strangers. Not that I don't love hearing it from other folks, but
yeah.
My partner, Joaquin Newman, who runs the youth center, well, he doesn't run the youth center, runs the arts program with me at the youth center. Joaquin likes to talk about when you first start, you have a lot of purchases from friends and family, which is great. That's actually fantastic. But there's a definite accomplishment when a complete stranger buys your painting. I think the first time that happens for any artist, that there's no connection to anyone in your circle, is great.
Yeah, I remember the first painting I ever sold that was a complete stranger. I mean, and I completely remember it. It was like such a big deal for me. Last question, my favorite one. If you could own a piece of art by any living artist, what would it be or whose?
Oh, that's a good question. Probably Mark Dalasio.
Really?
I absolutely love his plein air painting.
Is there one in particular?
Any one of his pieces from Big Sur. Or that sort of area. Anyone not familiar with his work, I would definitely look. I think he's, in my opinion, he's probably the best plein air painter at the moment. I don't necessarily think that of all of his studio pieces, but definitely I would own one of his plein air pieces.
Nice.
In a heartbeat. Yeah.
Gerard, thank you so much for taking the time to talk with me and sharing so much of what you do. I really appreciate it.
Thank you. It was really exciting to have this conversation. I think it was really great to talk a little bit about the work that I was doing with young people. Leading to this interview, I was thinking I had prepared most of my questions around that work because it's such an important part of who I am as an artist. And I've been really leaning into that recently around the idea around like reflecting of my legacy as an artist. And although I'm enjoying selling work and as a practicing professional artist doing murals and selling my paintings, for me, the work that I'm doing with the work around art education, art advocacy, community building is really where my heart is. And for me, that's where all a lot of my creative energy and spirit is going. So I'm blessed to have that opportunity to share my work with young people and share it with the community.
Absolutely. And they're lucky to have you.
Thank you.
I hope you enjoyed this episode of the Savvy Painter Podcast with Gerard Gutierrez. Show notes for this episode can be found at savvypainter.com. Just click on the podcast tab. You'll find examples of Gerard's work and links to everything that we talked about, plus links to connect with him, and of course, a link to the Savvy Painter community. The Savvy Painter Podcast is made possible by our sponsors and the generous donations of listeners like you. Thank you so much, Laura Fletcher. Hey, girl. Hannah Lake, Elizabeth Jacobs-Pinson, Denise Sanders, Danielle McDonald, Dorothy Ann Compton, Michelle Garfield, David Gorski, Jennifer Nickerson-Hoffman, Janet Vanderhoof. Janet, by the way, Janet, I'm not sure if you probably don't know this, but you were the first person to join the community when we opened it up for free. So congratulations, Janet, and thank you so much for supporting the podcast. I also want to give a shout out to Cheryl Churchill, Judy Pfeiffer, Kevin Costley, Margot Lehman, Jamie Campbell, Elizabeth Liebert, Carol Timmons, Martha Jordan, Ronald Chavez, Sarah Ross, Catherine Emery, Julian Davis, Beth Riley, Susan Zeftin-Kuhn, Catherine Wiley, Raquel Kramer, and drumroll please, because I'm finally going to get this name right, Corey Salaika. Thank you so much for being a supporter of the podcast. Have a great weekend, and I hope I see you in our community.